arrival was almost unspeakable.
We are all evil in some form or another.
I'm not guilty.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Hello! We're the Bad Taste Crime Podcast coming at you with some ooky spooky stories. I'm Janelle.
I'm Vicky.
And I'm sorry, but I can't help it. I need to do accents.
Hello, hello.
We're here for you, Governor.
Welcome back to the podcast. If this is your first time listening.
Are you listening?
Oh, my God. This is the first time listening. A special hello to you. We've got a great show for you today. It's a real downer.
It's always a downer.
I gotta be honest with you, but it'll be interesting. So stick along for this wild ride.
It's gonna be weird.
It's gonna be real weird. Real weird. But first, let's head over to the newsroom. Fit to breathe, our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. So this week, okay, so I should have mentioned this in the intro, I feel
Uh-oh.
Like, because this episode, we typically do not get super political on this podcast.
Right,
the nature of what we're talking about today, it just ends up going there anyway, at least for me.
Mine's definitely about, not politics, but definitely how media affects things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I thought I would carry that theme over into our news today.
Sweet.
So this week, our news, it comes from straight from NBC News. Three men, 20-year-old Christopher Brenner Cook from Columbus, Ohio, 24-year-old Alan Frost from West Lafayette, Indiana, and 22-year-old Matthew Sowell from Oshkosh, Wisconsin, pled guilty to providing material support to terrorism after hatching a plot to disrupt the electricity grid in order to sow civil unrest and economic uncertainty in the hopes of triggering a race war.
Oh, I thought they were going to say anarchy. I was like, I'm down for blowing up some credit card buildings a la Fight Club. Oh, yeah. But it's about a race war.
No, it's about a race war.
Never mind.
Yeah, it's about a race war. Mm-hmm. They also, part of the plan was to kill themselves using what they called suicide necklaces. Containing fentanyl.
That's one way to do it.
if they were discovered by law enforcement. Police had actually pulled over Cook and Sowell in Ohio, where Sowell had taken some of the fentanyl, but he survived.
Well, I mean, what does that say about him and his proclivities outside of this?
The men met originally in a chat room in 2019, where they began hatching the plan.
4chan, 8chan.
Again, directly from the article, quote, Cook maintained the group's ideology by giving his co-conspirators a reading list that reinforced white supremacy and neo-Nazism.
Let me guess. Turner Diaries.
I don't know what was on
all
it.
Of Tucker Carlson.
Probably.
Got it right on the head.
So they had, and I'm just going to go right to the article for this stuff.
Yeah.
They had, the plan was to shut down the grid, right?
Yeah.
And part of their plan was also to, like, recruit people into this big plot. Like, this, every single step of this had, like, the earmarks of white supremacy. Like,
but, like, on their conspiracy board, how does electrical grid shutdown equal race riot?
I don't know.
I want to see the in-between of this sandwich, of this fascist sandwich.
Here. Yeah. The trio decided to disable electricity substations in major regions of the nation, essentially by shooting at them. Frost and Cook trained with an Armalite semi-automatic rifle to prepare. Let's see. Oh, here. They had conversations about how the possibility of the power being out for many months could cause war, even a race war, and induce the next Great Depression. Does that answer your question?
No, because didn't all of Texas have their power out for how many weeks because of snow and nothing happened except for Ted Cruz going on a vacation?
Oh my God, don't even get me started.
I mean,
I'm fucking over Governor
Abbott. If you're
going
to hatch a fucking plan, you need to think this shit out. First of all, just shutting the power down isn't going to do jack shit. Also, FEMA will come up in there. The Red Cross will come up in there. Like, you need to have a little bit more of a plan then. We're going to turn the lights out.
Yeah.
If you're going to want to incite a rice roar.
So what I will say is because they were charged and have taken a guilty plea, they originally were claiming innocence, but they've since taken a guilty plea. They have not been sentenced as of yet. And the case itself remains under seal. So a lot of these details, I have a feeling.
Which means they're trying to get other people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have a feeling that we will not know specific details other than what we know now for a while until the case is unsealed. I just found this one really interesting because there does seem to be this trend where you have these white supremacist groups that are like starting as these small little contingents of like three or four people that are going into these, like you mentioned, 8chan, 4chan, Parler.
Yeah, Parler was the other one I was thinking about.
Going in and trying to recruit people. Right now, it's especially happening because... Oh my God, this is going to be way in the rabbit hole for a minute. But
okay, let's go. Take me down.
Right now, it's especially happening because you have all of these people who were QAnon followers who are becoming disillusioned with the movement, and white supremacist groups are seeing that as their opportunity to be like, hey,
switch and bait.
If you liked QAnon, you're going to love white supremacy. Like,
it's like your TikTok suggestion.
Yes. Yeah, it's like the For You page for fucking neo-Nazis. Like. Yeah. So that is a thing that happens. Like, it's easy for people who are involved in one sort of conspiracy movement to be easily swayed over to these more radical.
Yeah, because if you have one common thread in between them, like the same thing with the Alex Jones thing, the Alex Jones to QAnon to the fascist groups, they all have like one or two things that they all agree on, that they all see eye to eye on. So it's very easy to kind of flip somebody or push them further into a different direction. They're like, well, I like this thing.
Yeah.
Maybe you also like this. Yeah. Like,
and then the next thing you know, you're storming the Capitol.
Right? Nobody wants children to be diddled, but also,
oh my God,
have you seen this crazy thing happening? Yeah.
So, just something to keep an eye on. Every once in a while, I like to mention these things because I don't know if there are people who are maybe not as involved in all things internet culture that realize this shit is happening, but it is happening.
Like, yeah. I listen to a lot of time anarchist-based podcasts. Mm-hmm. So they give you a lot of news without a slant because it's like, look at this fucking stupid shit that's happening right now. You know? Anarchy. Yeah. So a lot of the things that I listen to will bring up these things. Yeah. And like, they were bringing up the, you know, the convoy in Canada and then the other, the political convention that was happening last weekend. They had like another one that was white supremacist based. Yeah. It's the A something A.
Yep. And what's his face spoke? It is like, I don't see anything wrong with speaking to a group of white supremacists.
But that just shows like all of the fringe things kind of cross meshing everywhere.
Yeah.
But that's why all those like anarchist shows that I listen to are just like, do you see how easy it is to incite someone's anger by just saying this, we relate on this. You could also, potentially like this thing.
A hint, that's also how people get recruited into cults.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of crossover there.
I am waiting for the day. So I listened to this podcast called Was I in a Cult? And I'm waiting for, they like did like LuLaRoe as one. Mm-hmm. They go in deep. They had a podcast about how this woman thought her family was a cult. Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for the political based ones because I know it is coming.
That, I'm going to have to check that out. That sounds really
good. It's a good
show.
That
sounds like something I'd be into. Mm-hmm.
They were both also in a cult.
Oh, great.
He was a Mormon and she was in a cult that began as an acting school.
Okay.
And turned into a weird guru thing.
Cool.
So they both have very firsthand experience of that. Okay. But they tell really great stories and they look at what does it mean to be a cult? Can anything be a cult? How easy is it to get pulled into a cult?
Yeah.
So it's really interesting.
All right. So with that, we are going to move on to Netflix and Kill. This week, we are talking about the Netflix sensation, Inventing Anna.
I watched the whole thing.
It's
true Shonda Rhimes-esque if you enjoy her work.
I fucking loved it. I loved it. I loved every second of it.
Yeah.
And let me tell you why. First of all.
Please do. Because I was on the fence for some of it. I was like, oh, this is a bit much.
Okay. First of all, for those of you that don't know, we are talking about, so Inventing Anna is a biographical, it's not a documentary, it's a biographical what do they call those? Like
the biopic.
Biopic. Yeah. Yeah. There are some obviously fictionalized parts. They are really clever about in every episode saying every part of this story is completely true except for the parts that aren't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I love.
It's very funny. That's a very common thing to do now. They did that. I watched the Joe and Carol show too about Joe.
Oh. We will talk about that in a future episode.
They did because the same I have not thing. Quite done they were that like, yet. Yeah. This but is true almost.
It's also clever because in the case of Anna Sorokin, which is who the show is about, like that's very much her life. Like everything mm-hmm. is completely true except for the stuff that isn't, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like this nod wink to Anna Sorokin, aka Anna Delvey. So if you're unfamiliar, Anna Sorokin was a Russian born German
transplant.
She left Germany and came to the U.S. where she essentially conned like New York's top socialites.
Which apparently isn't that hard.
It is not that
hard. Keep doing it.
Yes. She was arrested after defrauding or intentionally deceiving major financial institutions, banks, hotels, and like I said, socialites. It was totaling $275,000, and she was convicted in a New York state court of attempted grand larceny, larceny in the second degree, and theft of services. She was sentenced to 4 to 12 years in prison and was released actually this year, or I'm sorry, last year in 2021, but she was immediately taken into the custody of ICE detention for overstaying her visa. They're working to get her sent back to Germany for overseeing her visa, but she's still in ICE detention, like fighting that case. Okay.
Yeah.
Inventing Anna. The one major thing that I've heard from people, it seems people either really like it or people could not watch it because of her accent.
Yeah, that was the hard part.
Which I'm like, the thing is like, okay, she does have an unusual accent. She's speaking in English with a very heavy, like it's like a combination of German and Russian accent.
And I know the woman had a particularly strange accent. You can hear her. But like there were some points where you could just hear how how she was really forcing it.
Yeah.
So.
But I'm also like, that's how she sounds, though. Like, that's really how she sounds. So the way the show is set up is it follows this writer for The Manhattan named Vivian something, who is, that is not her name in real life. It's based off of another, the woman who did write the article, follows her as she is investigating Anna and interviewing her while she is in prison. So it's sort of, as the case is progressing, they have these look backs onto the stuff that Anna was doing, the people that she was involved with, the scam she was pulling. There's definitely, I mean, you know me, I love like a good fraud story. There's definitely something about this that has you sort of rooting for her because like for me, it's very much like this eat the rich mentality.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Fuck those people. But at the same time, you know, like homegirl was like on a large scale of fraud.
She went a little crazy. There was a line where it was like, you could have gotten away with it and not like push yourself too far into it. But then she crossed it. She crossed it hard.
And she did have some of the people represented in the show. All of the people represented in the show have real life counterparts. So,
yeah, the only thing that was like they did. This is the weird thing. The guy who played her boyfriend is a conglomerate of people because of the sensitive nature of a lot of what these people are doing. You can get sued very easily. So they kind of mashed some characters together so that they would avoid lawsuits.
The other thing was in the court filings and in the article, he was never named as like they never put out his name. So people don't necessarily know who he is. He was a tech
but she dated
entrepreneur.
A couple guys at once. She was living with the guy who was running Fire Festival.
Yes.
Which is like
Literally, there are parts of that show
you about
that you're like, this can't have happened. And it fucking did. Yeah. Billy, his name is Billy something.
Yeah. But like that moment, I was like, this just goes to show you how fucked everything is.
She was going out to dinner with Martin Scorsese.
Yep.
Like, remember him, guys? Like, what a fucked
farmer bro.
Yeah. The stupid farmer bro. Like, what an asshole. These people. Yeah. She was just like, you know, hanging out with.
Yeah.
If you want something that is not a documentary, which there are a lot of these series, you mentioned Joe V. Carroll. We will be talking about the Theranos won.
Oh, yeah. I started watching that.
I started watching that, which Amanda Seyfried.
Dropout.
In that, the Dropout, yeah. Mm-hmm. Amanda Seyfried in that is amazing. It's like spot
her.
On Anna.
But I we love will, her voice. Yes, oh, my God.
We will talk about that on a later episode. But, like, this is the trend that is happening now, where they are having these biopic series come out about these crimes that were really, really popular rather than releasing documentaries. A lot of these, like The Dropout, is based on a podcast of the same name, which if you've not listened
we've
to it.
We've talked about it.
Yeah, we've definitely talked about it. I would encourage you to listen to it. It's really, really good. And it followed her trial, which if you don't know, recently finished up. I know we talked about that in one of our more recent episodes when we did kind of the quick fire news. So
yeah. And she got married in the middle of that. I was like, what the fuck?
And how?
What?
Had a baby.
Like, what?
Yes. So we'll be talking. You'll probably hear more of those in the next couple episodes. I think we're definitely going to be looking at some of those because they have big name actors. Kate McKinnon, I think, is right. Yeah. And she does like a dead on character. I can't wait to talk about that one.
The jokes are so good, too.
Oh, my God.
Like the dry. Oh.
Yes. Yeah. We will get to all of that. But for now, this is that part of the show where we say content may not be appropriate for all listeners. We will be talking about child sexual abuse.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mine too. I mean, yeah.
There's no way to sugarcoat it.
Yeah.
I realize not everybody is super comfortable with that subject. We need to put it out there. There's also going to be some discussion in politics. Again, not something we typically do, but I also want to put that warning out there because it's going to get real hairy later.
Yeah.
But yeah. Janelle, why don't you tell us what we're talking about today?
Well, I've wanted to talk about this story for a while. So I had a fascination with England when I was younger because I was really obsessed with the Sex Pistols.
I still do.
To a degree. So every once in a while I get pulled back in, like when I watch a period drama like Downton Abbey or whatever.
Yeah.
Or Bridgerton. I'm like, oh girl, I really want some crumpets. So I knew a little bit about this gentleman. And this episode actually was kind of more prompted because of the docuseries I had watched about Bill Cosby. We need to talk about Cosby. I don't know if you saw
that. Okay, I have not seen that
yet. It's really good. You definitely should fucking watch it.
We will talk about it on the show when I get there.
I highly recommend it. It takes apart like our obsession with celebrity and how a lot of times we choose not to see things that are happening because we are so like inundated with the celebrity. Like we just get so starstruck that we just kind of everything around that becomes fuzzy.
Okay. So it's like less about Cosby and more about the way we as a society sort of view celebrity. And
it's all about that issue through his case and how he became a celebrity.
Okay.
So it's really interesting. It kind of gets into constructing image and controlling and no consequences for those rich people. But I wanted to look at the British version of that. And this is going to be like the life and crimes of the pervert sexual predator, Jimmy Savile.
Yeah, what a fucking weirdo. I'm looking forward to this, but yeah. He's a weird dude.
Yeah. Yeah. Look up a picture of him.
Yeah.
And you'll be like, what the fuck?
He kind of reminds me of like a blonde version of the Berries and Cream guy.
Yeah, he also looks like Captain Kangaroo a little bit, minus the mustache.
What was... when was the last time I saw a picture of Captain Kangaroo?
Yeah, he gives me hardcore Captain Kangaroo vibes. So Jimmy Savile was born in 1926 in Leeds, England. This was just after World War I, and it was like the time when like Ireland was fighting for separation from England. There was like all of this financial turmoil in England because, World War I really fucked shit up. Yeah. And then shortly after his birth, the world was pushed into the Great Depression, which affected like everybody. And it was worldwide. We tend to think it's very like centralized to the United States, but a lot of people depended on us. So it affected everything and it really affected England. In a 1989 Times London article, Savile was quoted as saying, quote, "I was forged in the crucible of want, and I consider myself far more privileged." And I wanted to put that in here because I really think that encapsulates his behavior.
Okay.
To a T. Okay. So he was forged during the Great Depression, an era of wanting simple things.
Sure.
And now that he had become this rich dude and he was out of that, he could get whatever he wanted because of his privilege.
Okay.
So very interesting insight into his character. During World War II, at the age of 18, Saville was conscripted, which means that he was drafted, to be a Bevan boy. If you don't know what that is, it's a group of boys who were sent to work in the coal mines during the war to increase production to aid the war efforts. So people were getting conscripted into other kinds of jobs that weren't really necessarily able to go into the army.
Okay.
So
they were run by the military, yeah. But they were just like regular jobs.
Yeah. So people were conscripted into jobs and, you know, that were required for men. So they needed a men in this specific job. So a lot of boys wanted to go work in these coal mines.
Gotcha.
Which is just really weird. Shortly after starting there, however, there was an explosion that injured him. And he spent a short while in a metal corset and walked with a cane until he fully recovered.
Okay. That's a look.
Mm-hmm. It was this time that kind of changed his career path. He's like, I'm not going to be working in these coal mines for my life. So Saville would start his celebrity career as a radio hall DJ in 1940s London. So we're talking full World War II swing. All of these dances for, you know, the men in the war. Very like Casablanca-y kind of vibes coming off of this. He started to play at dance halls and he claimed that he was the very first DJ because he was using two turntables and a microphone in his setup. Of course, this is bullshit. There are advertisements that go back to like the invention of fucking gramophones that display dual turntables.
Oh my God.
So like it was always a thing.
What a grifter.
Yeah. And it was a very easy kind of marketing ploy. Like, why have one when you could have two and flawlessly transition from one record to the next? So, like, he just bought into it and was like, I am the person who created this.
Right.
He didn't. Okay. In the 1950s, he started working at Decca Records, as well as playing ballrooms and dance halls. Now, the thing about the dance scene, however, it was full of underage girls.
Oh, my God.
Think of, like, American Bandstand.
Okay.
It was all screaming teenagers.
Sure.
After a certain hour at these dance halls, supposedly, no one was allowed in if they were under 18. But if you were cute and young and you had a tiny skirt on, more than likely they'd let you in anyway.
Yeah.
I've experienced this firsthand.
As I say, that's very of the time, but like, that shit still happens.
It still happens. Yeah. I was let into lots of things illegally at 16.
Yeah.
If you got the bosoms, they let you in.
Oh my God.
Now, they were letting all these underage people in, not to mention the fact that they were also serving them fucking alcohol.
Oh, of course.
They're like, sure, girl, champagne, why not? Yeah. It was the perfect place for a sexual predator to work at, and he controlled the guest list as well, so he was letting certain people in and out and, you know, definitely went heavy on the underage girls.
Well, and they have a lower drinking age there anyway, right?
Yeah.
Is 18?
I think so, yeah. But they were letting people in that were like 14.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, even if they had a time that was 18 and over, like, yeah.
And this, like I said, was the heyday of American Bandstand and Dick Clark. So there were lots of people emulating his aesthetic and the show. Mm-hmm. But Saville made sure to appeal to the younger crowd, specifically younger girls. That was his, like, forte. He always had a crowd of 16 to 17-year-old girls around him, like everywhere he went, like a gaggle of teens. And this is where the first sexual allegations against him started.
Okay.
The natural next step to his career was to work at an actual radio DJ, which is what he started to do in 1958. First, he worked at Radio Luxembourg, which was the number one station at the time. Everyone knows Radio Luxembourg. Very, like, popular top of the pops, guys. Mm-hmm. Saville spent 10 years at this station, and at one point, he had 6 shows going at once.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah. It was also at this time that he started working in TV a bit. He was a presenter on Young at Heart, which was a music TV show, and he co-hosted television music shows, like, all over the place.
Okay.
He was courted by BBC, and this is where it's going to get interesting, and appeared on Top of the Pops. That was his shit. That's where he got popular. That was his show.
Yeah.
And BBC was very interested in his, like, dynamic and his look. This is before he became Captain Kangaroo-esque. He was still a little, like, slicked back, kind of 1950s mod. Very mod still.
Okay.
I
love that.
His aesthetic
mod
would change.
Look is like,
yeah. Mm. His aesthetic would change in the 70s to that weird, like, short platinum blonde.
It's so, seriously, if you have not done it yet, Go look up a picture of him.
He looks like a little Dutch boy. It's very weird. He's
terrifying. Yeah.
I hate it. He was doing all these things, and he would be on set even at times that he was not scheduled to appear. He was, like, in control of everything. And there were several stories during this time of his misconduct, which were not, unsurprisingly, all ignored. Ian Hampton of the band Sparks was on the show 15 times, and he recalled in an interview a time where he questioned Seville's behavior. He stated he thought Seville considered Top of the Pops a hunting ground for young women.
Yeah.
And one night, he saw Seville take a girl to his dressing room, and after some time, she left looking really shaken. So Hampton went to the producer and asked, "What's the deal with Seville?" And the producer told him not to be ridiculous.
Okay.
So there were people questioning his behavior.
Oh, God, yeah.
Even some of the things he said on the show were weird and questionable. And I couldn't help but keep thinking about going back to Bill Cosby and all of his Spanish fly jokes.
Yes.
It was stuff. This guy was doing the same thing. He is literally the British version of Bill Cosby.
Oof.
He would grab and hold women. Some of them in the footage that I watched, you will see they are visibly shaken. I'm going to show you, like, there's a video link. We'll listen to it. And we'll see some pictures of him actively grabbing and assaulting women on live television.
Great.
Some even resorted to just going limp like rag dolls and just letting him do whatever he wanted. Like, there is a video clip of Top of the Pops. I watched a documentary.
Okay.
And they showed like back-to-back video clips during this point.
Dude, that's fucked up.
There's this one point where he grabs this woman around her waist and then slides his hand up to her breast, and she just, like, her face just goes blank. She just, like, becomes a rag doll. It was the most mortifying thing I've ever seen.
That's horrible.
Several women complained to all the producers, and they were told to get lost.
Wow.
And did not come back. The minimum age for attendance for the show was 16, but it was widely known that girls as young as 13 were attending the recordings.
Oh, my God.
Some were even invited backstage if they were dressed nicely enough. And they'd be given champagne and told to party with the staff managers and, of course, Jimmy Seville.
Ugh.
One of these women was Kelly Gold, and they recalled going to the show dressed up and being invited to his dressing room. At the time, she was 15, and they gave her champagne. She recalled the floor managers telling girls that they were asked to go to Seville's dressing room. She stated that there was a day bed in his dressing room and that girls were being groomed in that room.
Oh, my God.
There was a lot of touching and drinking that led to other things, and there were always more than one girl, like, in the room to make it seem like it was normal and fine.
Wow.
So,
that's fucked up.
Very purposeful behavior.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to show you a quick clip from one of the Top of the Pops episodes in the 70s to show you some of the, like, blatant assault on live camera.
Okay.
So we're just going to listen to this clip really quick, and we'll put the link in there so you can watch it, too, because the picture
is on your side of the crazy. Table.
It's fine. We still have a commercial.
The trouble is, it's on air. You know you're on air. You're with a very high-profile, popular presenter. He's literally got his hand where it shouldn't be and is assaulting you. What could you do in that situation?
I actually couldn't do anything because there was all people around and we were on steps and he was there and I couldn't move because there was too many people around and the camera was
grabbing her
in front of us. So, no, I couldn't get away. I told a man that was next to the cameraman. And he just told me to get lost.
He grabbed her ass and her waist.
That's just Jimmy. Go away.
Did he? I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail, obviously, but did he put his hands under your clothes?
Well, no, it was just literally I had trousers on, not a skirt, but his hand was there just groping. Yeah. And it wouldn't move.
And I think the look on your face is, it's that sense of, I don't know what to do in this situation.
Because
we're on a show where I'm supposed to be having fun.
Mm.
And yet this hideous thing is happening to you.
I was embarrassed because all I could...
Yeah, so that was... I have another video if you want,
wow.
If you want to come back for this one.
Okay. Yeah, that was...
So that was, like, the most blatant of him grabbing someone where she actively jumped out of her fucking seat.
Yeah.
Because he groped her so hard.
Really uncomfortable.
Yeah, and it's so weird because it looks like he's not really moving at all because there's people in front of him blocking.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is just an MO.
Oof.
Another woman who was interviewed was Colleen Nolan. She was only 14 at the time. And you can see in the video how he grabs her and talks about taking her to a motel.
I have to mention, Colleen, that the unfortunate revelations about Jimmy Savile at the moment, which I think have disappointed and shocked us all. You yourself had experience of working with him. What were your feelings?
She's 14 in this.
Well, you know, at the time I was 14 and it was just an uncomfortable situation.
Well, you found yourself in a situation with him.
Yes, I mean, he was, the girls were doing Top of the Pops and I stood with him while he made the announcement. And it was an uncomfortable situation, the way he held me. And then he mentioned about going to a hotel. But that, you know, you didn't talk about those things then, you didn't think anything more about it. I just thought, oh, I don't like that. You know, 14-year-old, and to me, he was 112 then, you know, at 14. And I thought, no, thanks. Now, obviously, compared to what else has come out in these other women, I mean, it's so much more about them. What happened to me was just... Yeah, and like you say, what could have been? Who knows what could have been if I'd have been on my own? But luckily, I was at the backup of the Witches of Eastwick.
Do you think it is?
So, in that clip, he is... If you watch the full video, he starts much higher, touching her boob, and then slides his hand down to her waist. And she is 14 years old in, like, a fucking pantsuit.
Yeah.
And her sisters are playing the show, and he's with her, kind of like talking to her while they introduce the girls and just groping her on live air. And then after they cut the mic, basically asking her and joking, like, we're going to go to a motel later.
Yeah.
Just fucking creepy, disgusting behavior. Now, this is a trigger warning for suicide, so I might want to skip that. Okay, here we go. In 1971, Claire McAlpine was a 15-year-old dancer who was frequently on the show. Claire was seen going into Seville's dressing room several times. Just 1 year later, Claire told Kelly Gold, who we had talked about earlier, that she thought she might be pregnant as she was very, very late.
Ooh.
Not long after this, Claire McAlpine took her life. The picture they posted in the paper below, you can see her next to Seville, which appears like they're actually holding hands in the picture. McAlpine was adopted, which affected her greatly, and her adopted mother, not long before her death, came to the BBC to report that a celebrity had been seducing her underage daughter.
Oh, God.
They obviously brushed her off.
Good job, BBC.
And this part of the story would not come out until decades later. But the documentary interviewed Kelly Gold, and they showed this picture, and it straight up looks like they're fucking holding hands. And... she was 15 years old, and the rumors are that he got her pregnant, and it's just unfortunate, but she killed herself, because obviously there was nothing she thought she could do.
Right.
So this is, like, one of the sadder parts of the story, but it just goes to show, like, the absolute blatant disregard that he had for any of these women.
Yeah.
In 1968, he also started to work at Radio 1, and he started doing this show called Savile's Travels. He had his own caravan trailer that he took around to do his show because he would go all over. And he would travel around and he would often brag about having underage girls in his travel caravan.
Jeez, what a slime ball.
So he's doing Top of the Pops groping girls on here. Yeah. He's doing his Savile's Travels, going around coercing young women into his trailer.
Jesus.
So doing a lot.
Yeah.
In the late 70s into the early 80s, Savile started some philanthropic affairs.
Okay.
This would be his main focus for a long time and become a secondary area for him to assault women.
Oh, great.
So he started to donate large sums of money to hospitals first, and then he began to volunteer as a porter. He raised money for the spinal unit, NCIC, which is the National Spinal Injury Center, and St. Francis Ward, which is a ward for children and teens with spinal cord injuries.
Okay.
Savile also volunteered at Leeds General Infirmary and Broadmoor Hospital. His main focus, though, was at Stoke Mandeville Hospital, where he had his own bedroom on site.
That doesn't seem troublesome. Mm-mm.
One woman whose name had been redacted in this story started there to get spinal treatment for a genetic disease. She met Savile there. One day while he was visiting, he wheeled her back to her room, you know, kind of just like a, let me do this for you, kind of a gesture. According to her, quote, he put his hands on my legs, stared me in the eyes, and proceeded to assault me.
Wow.
She was so afraid of talking about it, as everyone thought he was an angel. And because of his work and donations, he was able to have unsupervised visits on premise with basically anyone.
So this whole time I was thinking, well, maybe he's doing some of this philanthropic work out of guilt, because that is a thing that happens to us. I think especially when you see like white collar crime, like they use mm-hmm. philanthropy as sort of a way to, you know, look over here kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Which definitely seems like that's more of what this is. It's like, hey, look over here at all this good I'm doing. But it also, like you said, got him the benefit of having unsupervised visits to these.
Yeah.
People.
What really struck me was his having a bed.
Yeah.
The bedroom at the hospital?
That's weird.
What?
That's weird.
That doesn't make any sense to me at all.
That would definitely not be something that happens.
That's the biggest fucking red flag I've ever seen in my life. Like, you can't miss that.
That's weird.
In addition to all of this, he would also do marathons to help raise money for research. He donated large sums to research, and from 1974 to 1988, Saville was the honorary president of FAB, which is the Physically Handicapped and the Able-Bodied Community Organization, which is so fucked up because he is assaulting all of these women. At this time, he also wrote an autobiography called As It Happens in 1974, which contains admissions of improper sexual conduct in 1978. So again, I just kept drawing all of these connections back to Cosby, because he would talk about how he would drug women as a joke. And it's not a joke. He was really doing that.
Yeah.
Ugh. So in 1978, Johnny Rotten, if you're not familiar with who he is, Sex Pistols, he was doing an interview about his new gig, The Public Image, where he was like just chatting, and it's a very fucking long interview. You can listen to it on YouTube.
Okay.
But he was quoted in this interview because he started talking about Saville's sexual misconduct. It's a really interesting thing. It started off where they were talking about how he was very anti-establishment and he doesn't like celebrity and he doesn't like to be out in the public eye and be seen,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of the whole impetus for his Public Image project.
Okay.
But Lydon stated, quote, "I'd like to kill Jimmy Saville. I think he's a hypocrite. I bet he's into all kinds of seediness that we all know about, but we're not allowed to talk about it. I know some rumors." He added, "I bet none of this will be allowed out." So this was 1978.
Oh, my God. That totally gives me, I don't know if you've, I'm sure you've seen it. There was that interview with Courtney something on the red carpet that said, oh, if you can give advice to women and young women in the business, like, what would it be? And she was like, don't go to a hotel room with Harvey Weinstein. Have you seen that? Oh, yeah.
Courtney Love.
Courtney Love. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. I was, and that is like so, you know, you always talk about hindsight, right? Like, mm-hmm. in hindsight, all this shit looks really sketchy. In hindsight, the Spanish Fly set looks really fucking sketchy. Like, that's all in height, mm-hmm. but it's just like very eerie, and people were not listening. The BBC mm-hmm. was not listening. Like,
no, they purposefully covered this up.
Yeah.
So that's the other aspect of this case that we'll get into.
Yeah.
So from 1975 until 1994, he also had a show that he presented called Jim'll Fix It, which was an early Saturday evening television program in which he arranged for the wishes of viewers, mainly children, to come true. So this was another opportunity for him to commit some sex crimes.
Wow.
Saville then set up two charities, the Jimmy Saville Stoke Mandeville Hospital Trust in 1981 and the Leeds-based Jimmy Saville Charitable Trust in 1984. He even had a good relationship with the royal family.
Okay, that doesn't surprise me.
Well.
The royal family, like... I have
Pederasts? Is that what you're saying, Vicky?
I have very mixed feelings on the royal family, but the fact is they house a lot of really unsavory characters within their ranks.
Yep.
To put it lightly, you know.
Very lightly.
Very lightly.
So he befriended Prince Charles and Margaret Thatcher. Nobody liked Margaret Thatcher, so that's fine. Thatcher even wanted to knight him. But there was public outcry as he was quoted in the paper saying he would pick up young girls during charity marathons.
That's fucked up.
However, he was eventually knighted in 1990.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
Jesus.
So it was also during this time that he became really close to Prince Charles. He would often show up unannounced to their home. He was even seen licking Princess Diana's hand at a gig that caused a huge rift between the prince and the princess. It was supposed to be a joke. Well, and because he was a jester of sorts, people didn't think that was abnormal because he did weird shit all the time. But she like fucking knew that he was a creep.
Yeah.
She knew.
Well, she was married she told to a him, fucking creep.
Yeah,
so.
She told Prince Charles that he was not allowed at their home ever again.
Yeah. Dude, okay, so here is the deal. Like, Princess Di knew he was a creep because she was married to a fucking creep and knew it. Mm-hmm. Like, you can look at what's happening now and...
look at the company you keep.
Yeah, like, Prince Charles was literally cheating on Princess Diana the entire time they were together.
Epstein's flight list.
Epstein's flight
list. Hello.
Yes. Oh, my God.
We're not a political podcast.
This is why I had to give just like a blanket political warning for this podcast. Because especially in mine, like, we're going to get into it.
Yeah.
Into the shit. But like, it's just, it's unavoidable when you have stuff like this that is so far reaching into government.
Mm-hmm.
It just, it has.
And the royals can do no wrong.
For some reason, the government seems to attract people who like to sexually abuse other people, whether it's children or women or boys.
They just want to be like, in a position of power nonstop.
Oh. Yeah. Weird how that works out.
Yeah.
Ugh. Sorry.
It's I'll fine.
Get
no.
off of my soap. You didn't bring your soapbox in
today. I didn't
bring
my soapbox. It was the most appropriate day to bring it. In 1997, Seville had quadruple bypass surgery. And he really started to scale it back. Kind of like Bill Cosby.
Oh, God.
When he started not being able to see because of the cataracts. Jesus. I was like, God damn it, he is the English Bill Cosby.
He really is.
He would still continue to do charity work and make appearances, including an interview in 2009, which with his biographer working on a new updated version of his book. He made several comments defending viewers of child pornography, stating... they weren't doing the acts, only viewing them.
What?
I repeat, he defended people who viewed child pornography.
That's fucked up.
He even defended Gary Glitter, who, if you're not familiar, was famously outed for having child pornography.
That's fucking weird, man. That's just not right.
Yeah. So Seville was only ever formally interviewed regarding his crimes once. In 2007, Seville was interviewed under caution by police investigating an allegation of indecent assault in the 1970s at the now closed Duncroft Approved School for Girls near Staines, Surrey, where he was a regular visitor. Again,
oh my God.
Fucking creepy.
Yeah.
The girls' school was for at-risk women, and tales of abuse were fucking rampant. This was discussed in length in several articles that were published in 2015. The article in The Guardian that I read outlined that Seville committed 46 sexual assaults on 22 pupils and one visitor.
Wow.
13 victims were abused on at least two occasions by Seville, and five were assaulted when the school was under the control of Bernardo's Children's Charity in October 1976.
I feel like his total is somewhere in the hundreds, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Of
oh, yeah, at least.
Women that he sexually abused. Like, that's insane.
Yep. Detectives found that 25 of Seville's 46 sexual offenses took place within the Duncraft's grounds, including in and around the principal's office, the entrance to the fucking school, the communal TV room, the kitchen, and the dining room.
Ugh.
Of the abuse that took place off-site, 13 attacks were allegedly carried out in Seville's car. The nature of Seville's offending ranged from non-consensual kissing to forced oral sex.
Jesus.
And these were girls who were already at a bad point in their life. They had to go live basically in an orphanage, and they were just...
Jesus.
Left there to be assaulted by this man who would come and go as he pleased.
Mm-hmm.
The tragedy of this story is that Seville's crimes were not outed or publicized until after his death. Seville died in 2011 with a grandiose funeral. His casket was displayed in Queen's Hotel in Leeds, and 4,000 people attended his funeral.
Oof.
Immediately after his death, BBC Newsnight started an investigation. So they're like the Dateline of England. This is where the Duncroft School stories came out, which would open the door for a flood of stories about his abuse to just unravel the whole goddamn thing.
Interesting, because I feel like the BBC...
Oh, they did not let it out at first.
Yeah. I was going to say, the BBC was clearly, like, covering
this
up.
There were court cases. There was a whole... Like, that Newsnight story is, in and of itself, a whole nother episode.
Okay.
On September 20th, 2012, almost a year after his death, ITV said it would broadcast a documentary as part of its exposure series called The Other Side of Jimmy Savile. So after Newsnight started airing stuff, it was just a cavalcade of people going off on this guy.
Yeah. And I've heard some really good things about the exposure series, actually, mm-hmm. that they, like, their investigations are really, really good.
Yeah.
Was that the documentary that you had watched?
No. Okay. I watched a different one. I watched a little bit of that one, but there was another one that was way more in depth that I watched. But it's up there somewhere in the notes.
Okay. Yeah.
I think it was on Conspire or something.
Gotcha.
Okay. So in 2012, Metro Police set up a unit to investigate his crimes. By October, there were 400 lines of inquiry based on testimony from 200 witnesses via 14 police forces across the UK.
Holy shit.
Over 450 victims had contacted the police.
Where did he find the time, honestly?
I really don't know. Honestly. I guess when you're doing it while you're working,
yeah,
it's
right?
not so hard. While you're so actively up. On television, being filmed.
Ugh.
The investigators described the alleged abuse as, quote, on an unprecedented scale, and the number of potential victims as, quote, staggering. It was shortly after these stories aired that businesses and charities started removing plaques and memorials to Savile.
Good.
His family even went as far as removing his headstone.
Wow.
They trashed it and sent it to a dump. He still has an unmarked grave to this day.
Really?
Yep, that's how far they went. They Good. Were so appalled by the allegations that they removed his fucking headstone.
Good.
Now, I'm going to just give you a brief timeline of the press after he passed for the story break, because it's really interesting to see things kind of go out of control.
Okay.
This is 2012. On October 8th, BBC Director General George Entwistle appeared on the Today program. Newsnight reporter Liz McKenyon emails him to express her unhappiness over the handling of the Newsnight Savile story, because they were trying to stop everything.
Okay.
Entwistle asks Ken McQuarrie, BBC Scotland director, to investigate why the show was initially axed. So they wouldn't let it go, and eventually it went off the chain. On October 13th, a criminal investigation called Operation Yew Tree was launched after a flood of complaints.
Okay.
On the 22nd, Panorama broadcast a special on Savile. On the 23rd, Entwistle appears before the Culture, Media, and Sports Select Committee to discuss the matter.
Okay.
Later that month, the BBC asks Dame Janet Smith to investigate the culture at BBC during the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Okay, so like the BBC being like invested. That's literally
we're going
like,
to investigate ourselves.
Us. Yeah.
I'm going to investigate myself.
Oh my God.
On November 10th, George Entwistle resigns.
Okay.
January 11th of 2013, the report from Scotland Yard, which collaborated with the NSPCC, finds that Savile was a prolific predatory sexual offender.
Shocker.
In 2014, June 26, a report into Savile's actions at NHS Hospital is presented to then Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt. Oof. It found that he assaulted victims in NHS hospitals over several decades, including Leeds General Infirmary, where 60 people aged from 5 to 75, including both staff and patients, stated that they had been abused by Savile. In February 26th of 2015, another report into the Stoke Mandeville Hospital found he had sexually abused more than 50 people there, including staff, patients, and visitors, one as young as 8.
Wow.
In 2016, the Dame Janet Smith report comes back, finding that the staff at BBC missed numerous opportunities to stop him.
Missed.
Heavy quotes
heavy
on that.
Quotes, yeah.
She identifies 72 people who were the victims of sexual crimes while he worked at the BBC, the youngest being 10.
Oh, my God.
The earliest reported incident was the rape of a 13-year-old girl at Limegrove Studios in 1959. The latest one that was reported was in 2006 at the last recording of Top of the Pops.
Wow.
Now, the review found misconduct had been committed at virtually everyone on the BBC premise at which he worked.
Okay.
She said some BBC staff were aware of complaints but did not pass the information to senior management due to the culture of not complaining. Saville's estate was worth £4 million at his death in 2011. It was distributed in 2016 to personal injury compensation complainants and various legal advisors. A significant number of individuals lodged claims against the estate after Saville's death, alleging sexual abuse against them. So all of his victims got whatever was left. Now, after all this, BBC faced a massive amount of backlash, obviously.
Good.
In November 2012, the BBC confirmed that it would no longer be airing repeats of Top of the Pops on BBC4 featuring Saville as a presenter, which is least they could fucking do.
They went the route of like the WWE where they just pretended it never happened.
It stated that it would be more aware and change its policy so nothing like this would ever happen again. Oh my God, cue the eye roll.
Yeah.
It only took how many decades for them to be called out about it? Get off. Ugh. Not much has happened besides that. They have not seen any lawsuits happening publicly, but that doesn't mean that there won't be any, as this case is still pretty ongoing.
Yeah. And it's even more difficult considering he dead.
Yeah.
Like,
they can still try to hold BBC accountable, though, because they were obviously very much involved.
Yes.
Now, to top this off, BBC decided to do something really interesting and get in front of the scandal, quote unquote, unquote. Last year, in 2021, it was announced that the BBC was making a series based on Saville's terrible deeds with Steve Coogan playing Saville. Oh, sweet Steve Coogan. Why?
I know, but the thing is like, Steve Coogan is definitely, like, you put a blonde wig on him, and he is definitely
I put pictures up here, and I was like, God damn it.
I was looking at pictures earlier and saw the series come up.
So sad, because I used to have a crush on Steve Coogan when I was younger. I'm not even kidding.
Why?
Wait, because I had a thing for British people.
I mean, I
was a teenager.
I did, too, but...
Don't ask Coogan. Questions. I was all about it, especially
when... He's a great actor, but, like...
I loved it. Exactly. It was mostly his voice that got me.
Okay, fair enough.
You know?
Fair enough.
Yeah. You don't get into British people for their looks, okay?
I don't know, man.
You get into them for their voice.
You got somebody like David Tennant.
Ooh. I do love David Tennant, but he's also not
beautiful.
Like traditionally gorgeous, right? He's like quirky,
he's
weird,
like nerdy,
cute.
Gorgeous. Yeah, that's true.
So again.
That's true. Fair enough. Fair enough. And now I'm trying to think of, like, traditionally handsome, like, Robert Pattinson. Like,
I don't
he is
don't
he is like that chiseled, like,
I don't know about that
thing. I'm not saying I find him attractive, but I'm just saying, like, he is like
he also
classically
has a weird,
handsome.
A weird gothy aesthetic to me.
Yeah, he was
outside of
by,
him playing
he
a
was
vampire.
Cursed by Twilight.
Yeah. Like, I mean, just God. His look makes me think like British man in a castle.
Yeah, true.
And as you can see by, like, all the photos that I put in here, he wore a lot of track suits. And I just want to end this with, never trust a man who exclusively wears track suits.
Advice to live by.
That is the story of sexual predator extraordinaire Jimmy Saville.
You know, I saw this topic. I had to cover a topic from our down home state of Illinois.
Oh,
like,
boy.
And this is one. So I didn't really start
honestly, Vicky, I thought you were going to cover Anthony Weiner. I honestly thought you were going to go that direction.
I was tempted. Yeah. I was tempted. I definitely knew that I wanted to cover something from the U.S. because, as I've said many times this episode, like, sexual abuse and U.S. politics seem to go hand in hand in some cases.
Which is why the whole Pizzagate issue hinges on reality.
Yeah. And like, like even now, like Matt Gaetz is being indicted for alleged sexual abuse.
We're going to say hardcore sexual abuse.
Yeah.
There is no alleged.
Still alleged because he has not been convicted in a court of law. And legally speaking, I'm not trying to get sued. So
come at me, Matt Gaetz. Come at this tiny podcast that no one listens to.
We had Anthony Weiner. We had oh my God, there has been so many that's like, okay.
A lot of them are Southern. I don't know if you noticed that.
A lot of them are like Southern white Republicans.
Yeah.
Weird.
I'm sure you know how that happens.
This one is not super Southern. He is a Republican. He is our very own Dennis Hastert.
Oh, God. Make it.
I know. And so I didn't really get into politics until probably, honestly, it was not that long ago. It was probably like 2014 in the run-up to
meanwhile,
the 20s.
You have me over here who's been protesting since diapers.
Yes. And I will say, like, in that time, I have become very politically active. Mm-hmm. I've definitely educated myself on things that are happening now. But to that same cause, like, there's a lot of stuff that has happened in the past that I am not totally aware of, that mm-hmm. I'm learning about, that I am hearing about as we research these things. Sometimes they come up and it's like, okay, and you start to connect the dots. The thing is I know Dennis Hastert. Mm-hmm. I know when we were in school, we learned he was the Speaker of the House at the time.
Right. Very classic. Yeah.
At mm-hmm. the time, he was from Illinois. I knew that. Like, yep. That was a big deal. But I was not aware of his career outside of that. Mm-hmm. And when he made the news in recent years for things that we will talk about, it was, I want to say it was surprising, but it really wasn't, just due to our track record of fraudulent politicians.
Yeah.
But let's dive into it.
Fraudulent. Yes. All of the problems.
So Dennis Hastert was originally from Aurora, Illinois. He grew up working in, his family had like quite a few businesses. They had a family farm. They had a farm supply business. And then when he was a little older, they actually had a family restaurant that he worked in as a fry cook. At some point in high school, he became a born again Christian while he.
What year was this?
This would have been in the early 60s.
Okay, that makes sense.
And he was going to Oswego High School at the time. Mm-hmm. And while he was there, he was also a star wrestler and a football player. Now, Hastert attended Wheaton College, which is I believe it's a private evangelical university,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where he graduated with a BA in economics. In 1967, he received his master's in philosophy of education from Northern Illinois University.
Hey.
So he's a fellow alum. You should
gross.
Be proud of that. No. Yeah.
We are super like gross. The number one education school. So
it's true. Yeah. While he was, this makes it even worse. While he was attending NIU, Hastert worked for Yorkville Community Unit School District 115, teaching high school government, history, economics, and sociology, along with coaching football and wrestling.
Classic.
In fact, Hastert was able to lead the Yorkville High School wrestling team to the state title in 1976, even earning himself Illinois Coach of the Year.
Interesting.
Along with coaching, Hastert stayed.
Interesting.
These are all things I'm going to say remember for later.
Yes.
Along with coaching, Hastert stayed active in the community by volunteering with the Boy Scouts Explorer Post 540.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
These are all red flags.
Just working with the Boy Scouts is a red flag.
Boy Scouts, fry cook, wrestling coach. Red flags.
Evangelical.
Right? Yeah. Evangelicals, number one.
After 16 years of working as a high school teacher and coach, Hastert took a sharp turn into politics.
Is it really that sharp?
Yeah.
I mean, education is political.
It is, but he does not, like, even at the time, he admitted, like, he didn't know anything about politics. He had his BA.
Wait, wasn't he teaching it?
He was.
Government?
He was teaching government, yes. I will argue that government is very different from politics.
I mean, but you have to talk about politics to talk about government.
Yes, but government, the just way the government functions and the politics of that government, I think are two very different things. Mm-hmm. So like you can know how the government is supposed to functionally work and mm-hmm. know nothing about politics and probably wouldn't be very successful.
Well, I mean,
but like,
I don't know, though, because like the entire impetus of the organization of that system was because we were trying to avoid the way that you know, oligarchy and things were influencing quote unquote government in England.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I do think, I mean, can you talk about one without the other? Not really. But I do think you can look at them as two totally separate things, because mm-hmm. there is a system we have set in place of how the government is supposed to function, ideally, with rules and regulations and all sorts of things. And then once you have our friend over here, politics, that sort of enters the equation, it really, really, like, muddies everything up.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, point is, he did not consider himself a political person and kind of decided, because he was originally considering into going into administration, like educational administration, and applying for, I think, a principal job.
Which is very political.
Yes.
It's gross.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Instead, he decided to go into politics. Like I said, he had said at the time, I don't know anything about politics. Some people may argue that is still the case. But his first run in the 1980 Republican primary for the Illinois House of Representatives was a failure, although it did net him quite a few political connections. Afterward, Hastert began volunteering for State Senator John E. Grotberg before being tapped to replace Representative Al Shoberin?
Sure.
after he fell terminally ill. During this time in the Illinois House, Hastert gained a reputation for being on the far right politically, but being able to set aside partisanship and negotiate across the aisle.
Big words.
Yes. Of note, during his time in the House, Hastert fought against the Equal Rights Amendment, which, for those that don't know, ERA wow. was about equality for women.
Surprise. Color me surprised.
Yeah. And he opposed legislature that banned discrimination against homosexuality, as well as various efforts to deregulate utility companies.
Mm-hmm.
Very classically Republican.
Yeah.
In another interesting twist, Hastert kickstarted his career in national politics by replacing yet another sick congressman. It's funny going through his career because he just seems to kind of luck out on people getting wicked sick
mm-hmm.
and then just like sneaking in to replace them, which I guess good timing, but like weird. In 1986, Grotberg, who is currently serving as the representative for Illinois' 14th district and who Hastert had previously worked for, was diagnosed with cancer, preventing a run for a second term. Hastert was nominated to run for his seat, eventually winning over Democrat Mary Lou Kearns. Now, this is kind of where the scandals start creeping into his career. And this is not just sexual abuse scandals, but these are like political scandals. Like it's all sorts of stuff. In 1992, the House banking scandal, also known as Rubbergate.
I love the names.
I know. So Rubbergate broke, implicating around 400 representatives, many of which didn't actually commit any crimes. The gist of it is that it had to do with the U.S. House of Representatives allowing members to overdraw their house accounts without any consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Hastert himself had bounced 44 checks in that time period.
What?
Yes.
What?
44 checks. But was cleared by the Department of Justice, who said he probably hadn't done anything illegal.
Okay, except for if it was a regular person, they'd be fucking arrested for fraud.
Yeah, probably.
That's fine.
Probably. I will say, so like that, Rubbergate is like its own thing to look into. A lot of these things that I'm going to touch on today are, because they're like their own big scandals.
Yeah.
And part of it had to do with this checking account that is run through the U.S. House of Representatives is actually a clearinghouse.
I have to deal with that at work.
Which
it's all confusing and fucking stupid.
As soon as they were like, well, it's actually a clearinghouse, I'm like, yep, I know all about I know as much as I need to know about this. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't need to get into financial things or not. As much as I find them interesting, they are not my forte in like understanding what's going
on. It's stupid. I hate accounting, and I think it's fucking dumb. Just give me a budget, and that's it. Just tell me I'm allowed to spend this much money in a year.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
It infuriates me.
So following this little speed bump, Hastert quickly rose through the ranks, eventually becoming the heir apparent of the House Speaker. During this time, AP described Hastert in the following way.
Okay.
Quote. During 6 terms in Congress, representing a GOP-leaning slice of farmland and far-flung western Chicago suburbs, Hastert had made his mark brokering backroom compromises that balance many competing interests. He is an evangelical Christian who opposes abortion and advocates lower taxes, a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, and the death penalty. And to wrap it all up...
He's got it all.
I know. And to wrap it all up, quote, even as Hastert made a name for himself as a House Republicans leader on anti-narcotics efforts, he used that platform to crusade against federal money for needle exchange programs, which backers argue can help stem the spread of AIDS among drug users. Which you have to remember, like, at this time...
Notorious anti-AIDS.
Yes. And we were right in the middle of the AIDS crisis with a shit ton of mixed messaging coming from the Republican-led executive branch, who was like,
yep,
AIDS is a gay problem, which obviously we now know that is not the case. Like,
yeah. Not to mention the fact that just the sheer hypocrisy.
Oh, my God.
Of, like, Nancy Reagan's best friends with all these gay men who are literally fucking dying before her. And she's like, lol, no thanks.
Oh, my God. Don't even get me started on the Reagans.
Yeah.
In another interesting twist that seemed to work out in his favor, Hastert again propelled his career forward by stepping in at the right moment. In 1998, the House Speaker at the time, Newt Gingrich... Which is
old
a name,
Newt.
Name everybody old knows, Newty. I think. He actually opted to step down as Speaker and refused to serve his 11th term in Congress, leaving the speakership open. Now, at the time, Representative Robert Livingston of Louisiana had been selected to step into the speakership role, but announced he wouldn't be taking the seat due to controversy surrounding his newly public extramarital affairs. Oops.
They be fucking, you know?
Immediately, Hastert began bargaining for support to take the seat, eventually winning out and becoming the longest serving speaker of the House in U.S. history. He was eventually succeeded by Nancy Pelosi in 2006.
Again, another one to go fuck themselves.
Yes.
I hate Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, I'm not a
fervor.
I'm not a fan.
I don't like any politician. Really.
Yeah. Well, you're an anarchist. Like, really. I mean, I expect a less.
I mean,
yeah.
I can respect Bernie Sanders a little bit because he was really anarchistic in his beginnings.
Him. Yes. You know, he's my man.
Sold out.
It's fine.
Sold out, goddamn. I mean, what could I ask for? I mean, a man who would steal electricity? Yes. Did you know that?
No.
He stole electricity. He built a house, his first house with his wife.
Okay.
And he siphoned electricity.
Nice.
Like, he was, I'm not kidding,
get
he was
burned.
An anarchist.
I love that.
And he sold himself out.
So that's kind of just like a very brief overview of Hastert's sort of political career.
Yeah.
There's a lot to it. Like I said, it's all an entire rabbit hole of it in itself. But I wanted to kind of, like, before we get into the nitty gritty of this case, I wanted to highlight a few more of the scandals that sort of peppered his career. Norm Ornstein with The Atlantic wrote this really great article that's like, this is not the only scandal that Hastert has had. Here's all the other scandals that he had.
Yeah. As most politicians, you got to get a couple under your belt before you get a big one.
Yeah. So Representative Tom DeLay, one of Hastert's political mentors, was implicated in the Jack Abramoff scandal, which I'm pretty sure we talked about on the show. If not, we've definitely mentioned it in passing.
Probably.
I was like, I think I covered that at some point.
Things kind of blur together.
Yes. He was eventually indicted himself. This was followed closely by the revelation of Florida Representative Mark Foley engaging in inappropriate contacts with male pages.
Huh.
reports had been made to the Speaker's office and were ignored until it was made public. This is from the Atlantic article, quote, when Hastert mentor DeLay ran into problems, Hastert tried to bottle them up. When they became so pronounced and repeated that they could not be swept away, the Ethics Committee set up a subcommittee and did its duty, recommending a series of reprimands for DeLay in 2004.
Too many damn committees.
Hastert's response was to fire the committee chair, along with two other Republicans on the subcommittee, replacing them with loyalists, and the next year, seeking rule changes to make it harder to admonish his colleagues. Hastert also acted after three Texas associates of DeLay were indicted by enacting a rule that would enable DeLay to stay as majority leader if he were indicted.
God.
So he essentially was like, I'm getting rid of you guys that don't agree with me. Uh-huh. I'm putting these rules, like, just in case you get indicted, like, just to make sure that you can still stay on these committees. Like,
yeah, that's why the whole committee system is fucking stupid and pointless.
Yeah. Pastor also used his position of political power to enrich himself. Again, from the Atlantic article, quote, Hastert manipulated a series of complex land transactions in his home state of Illinois in concert with wealthy patrons to take his net worth from a negligible amount to many millions of dollars while he was serving as Speaker of the House, buying land at a low price while his associates purchased adjacent land at a much higher price, and then merging the parcels and creating a trust that gave Hastert an inflated share.
Why would you ever agree to that?
Money.
But, like,
money.
How is that beneficial to them? They're not making that much more if they're buying the parcel at a higher price.
Yeah, I'm sure there was probably some sort of power exchange, too. Like, we'll help you out with this if you can get this deregulation bill passed to make us more money on this side. Like, I'm sure there had to be some sort of backroom deal there.
So fucking dumb.
Again, there's, like, way more to all of this. But all of this is stuff that happened before the big scandal broke. Although he had won re-election for the 2007 session of Congress, the Republicans lost the majority in the House, and therefore Hastert would lose his position as Speaker of the House. If you remember, 2007, Barack Obama won the seat. The presidential seat for 2008.
That thing happened.
Yeah. So there was this huge flip of the House from Republican to Democrat. Shortly after the Republicans lost the majority, he announced he wasn't going to be seeking re-election for the 2008 term. And actually, he resigned it before he resigned it.
He resigned.
Actually, he resigned right before the end of the 2007 session. After finishing in Congress, Hastert joined the lobbying side of things and pretty much he joined the lobbying side of things. He pretty much then, like, lay low until May 2015 when federal officials announced an indictment from a federal grand jury.
Oh, boy.
Now, the let me start by saying that part of the reason I find this case really interesting, other than it's, like, another perfect example of fraud from Illinois that we have so many examples of, like, literally politicians in Illinois, please stop committing fraud.
We should just stop having politicians.
I am I'm trying to appeal to your better nature as somebody who lives in this state. Just stop, please.
Stop frauding.
Just stop.
Stop frauding so hard.
But the legal aspects of this case are so interesting, not in the best way. But they are really interesting. So the indictment alleged that in 2010, Hastert met with someone only referred to as Individual A to discuss past misconduct by Hastert against Individual A. Mm-hmm. During these meetings, Hastert agreed to provide $3.5 million in compensation for his past conduct.
Okay.
The indictment also said that both the FBI and IRS had begun investigating Hastert in 2013 when they started seeing these suspicious withdrawals happening out of his bank account.
Well, yeah.
And it flagged there is a federal regulation where banks have to report transactions larger than $10,000, I think. So they were seeing these withdrawals happening in certain amounts, and it kind of flagged something for the agencies as a way to avoid having to report these transactions. Mm-hmm. Their investigation was to find out what this money could be for, including whether he was specifically withdrawing cash in small amounts to avoid reporting it, whether he was using the money to cover up past misconduct, whether the money was being used for a criminal purpose, whether Hastert was part of a criminal extortion plot, or whether the money was being used for another purpose. Like, it was entirely possible that this was legit, but they had to look into it.
Yeah.
Now, Hastert was also accused of lying to the FBI.
Surprise.
About these payments when he was asked. Like, when the original indictment came out, it was all very vague. That's pretty much the information that was in there. It was like, we're looking into these payments. He met with Individual A about past misconduct. But more and more details about these payments would make their way into the public eye as the case went on. Now, the FBI first became aware something was up with Hasser in 2012, but the investigation officially began in 2013. So they went in to question him about the structuring of the withdrawals, and Hasser at the time kind of said, I don't really trust the banks, so I'm withdrawing my money to keep it in a safe place.
Mm-hmm. Which could be legit.
Right. It was a lie.
Well, yeah. Because you have to produce that
money. Could be legit, but yeah. Now, after the indictment was released and Hasser was arraigned, he was released on his own recognizance on bail of $4,500. The day after the indictment was released, a person familiar with the matter released to the press that Individual A was, in fact, a man who had been sexually harassed by Hasser during his time at Yorkville High School, and that of the $3.5 million requested to be paid, $1.7 million had actually already been paid out. What followed were more allegations of sexual misconduct from other students, which would end up being five in total from his time at Yorkville High School, where he was involved with the Boy Scouts Explorers Club and the wrestling coach.
Like, he was around all of the fucking children. Oh my God.
Yes. Yes. So,
wrestling, man.
This indictment comes out. There's like every day, sometimes like every hour, there's like details coming out about what these allegations actually are. People were wondering, okay, well, we only see these fraud crimes in here. Like, what's going on with that? So there's one major issue with all of this. And that is because of the length of time between the FBI's investigation and when the abuse happened, the statute of limitations had run out. Mm-hmm. So Hasser was unable to be indicted for these crimes, unfortunately. The allegations included Individual A being molested by Hasser in a hotel room while on a wrestling camp trip, with Hasser using the guise of a massage for inappropriate touching. Individual B being molested at 14 in a locker room, again with Hasser telling him to get on a table for a massage and instead performing a sexual act. Individual D made similar claims of the massage ruse, including that at one point Hasser had set up a lazy boy chair in direct view of the shower stalls in the boys' locker room.
I'm sorry. What?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. A full-on fucking lazy boy.
Yeah.
But they're not small.
No. And it was a lazy boy, like, type chair, like a recliner, but still, like, just like a fucking recliner to watch boys in the shower. Individual C alleged that Hasser brushed his hand over his genitals, making him incredibly uncomfortable. The only person to be named by name was Steve Reinbolt, whose story was actually being told by his younger sister, Jolene, Jolene Burge, because Steve had previously told, like, way back when they were in high school, Steve had told his sister about the abuse. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, he died in the mid-80s due to AIDS. Mm-hmm. And so he was unable to obviously fight for himself, but his sister very much like took on the mantle of making sure that her brother was being represented. I have total respect for this woman, because she talks about how, and this is, oh my God. So it makes me want to cry, honestly, because it's so fucked up. She talks about Hasser going to his funeral.
Oh my God.
When he died in the mid 80s, and confronting him outside and saying, what, you know, why did you do it? Why did you sexually abuse my brother all these years ago? And him not saying anything, not denying it, not, you know, trying to object, just like being quiet. And her straight up telling him, like, I want you to know that somebody knows, and this is never going to go away. And I am the person that is going to keep reminding you that I know what you did. Which, like, fuck yeah, girl. Yeah. You know, it just is sad. Really sad. Now, when all of this came to light, the media, of course, looked back on Hassert's career in kind of a new lens.
He's got to be doing it other places. You don't just molest a bunch of children and stop.
Well, and even just like looking at the stuff in his political career. So besides the obvious mishandling of the Mark Foley scandal, Hasser had a record of voting for tougher punishments for child sexual abuse.
Interesting.
Like, he even had come out and was like, I want to see every fucking pedophile in jail.
Interesting.
weird how that works out.
A little evangelical guilt there for you.
Oh my God, it's so true. Like, it is, it is. They always say the opposite of what they're actually doing. Mm-hmm. Hassert immediately resigned from the lobbying firm, and the Yorkville school district made a statement saying it was unaware of any abuse allegations against the former coach and teacher. Now, privately, Hassert was claiming to also be a victim of the ordeal, claiming that he was being extorted. I choked
to death. Okay, yeah. Victim.
Yeah, he was like, yeah, they're trying to extort me all this money, and then agreed to help the FBI by recording a conversation between himself and Individual A, where they were talking about these payments, and, you know, obviously he was trying not to report the money that he was taking out of his bank account, but at the same time was trying to essentially frame Individual A as this extortion plot. And he went in and the FBI was like, yeah, it was pretty clear to us that like this was not extortion, because in the replies to their conversation, like Dennis Hassert would say something. He said, yeah, Individual A was like really understanding, like, you know, you whenever you have the money is fine, you know, very there wasn't like a lot of pushback of like, no, I need it now.
Yeah.
It became very clear that it was actually the opposite.
And can it really, I mean, can it be extortion when you're the person who is being abused? It's not like you have tapes on somebody else, you know?
Yes. So, yes. Because if it's more of a blackmail situation where it's like, pay me this money or I release this information, like that's when it kind of goes into the extortion. But really, like what was happening here was essentially a settlement that was not involved in the courts.
Yeah.
It was not like a pay me money to keep me quiet, although they do call it hush money payments, but it was more of a pay me for my pain and suffering type deal.
Yeah.
Of course, this was extra big news considering the Illinois track record on corrupt officials. We had a lot of news about this here. Later in 2015, it was announced that Hassert had come to some sort of plea agreement related to the fraud charges and likely to continue to hide information relating to the sexual abuse allegations. Hassert pleaded guilty to one fraud charge. The lying to the FBI charge had been dropped as part of the plea agreement. Now, shortly after he was found guilty, shortly after, Hassert had a stroke that delayed the sentencing on his case. And there was like this bit of back and forth because Hassert kept delaying because of all these health issues. And this, like, the dude is not young. Like, he is not young at all. And of the like two, I think he had only appeared in court like two times in person. The first time he was there was when he was being arraigned. Second time was at his when he was convicted and he came in a wheelchair. I mean, he looked real frail.
That's also classic. When you get caught, your health tends to go downhill.
Harvey
real fast.
Weinstein did it. Yeah. Bill Cosby did it. Yeah. Like, yeah. So there was all this back and forth because he was having health issues, but then the judge was actually delaying the trial because he wanted the victims of the sexual abuse to be able to come into court and testify, give their testimony about the events that happened, which his lawyers didn't like. They were like fighting back, like, why can't we get this going now? And the judge was like, cool it. Yeah, it was the whole thing. Yeah, I know. So he finally showed in court to be sentenced. Also, as a part of the plea deal, the judge made sure that Hassert had to admit to his past abuse in court.
Oh, boy.
And that the victims, like I said, were allowed to testify. Although the statute of limitations had expired on the sexual abuse, the judge did consider this during his choosing of the sentencing. The prosecution said during court, quote, the federal and state statutes of limitation have long expired on potential charges relating to the defendant's known sexual acts against Individual A and other minors. These known acts consist of the defendant's intentional touching of minors' groin area and genitals or oral sex with a minor. With this case, the government seeks to hold defendant accountable for the crimes he committed that he can still be prosecuted. Defendant's structuring of cash withdrawals and his lies to the government about that activity. But those crimes, while recent, have their origin in the defendant's past. And when handing down his own sentence, the judge stated, quote, nothing is more stunning than having the words serial child molester and Speaker of the House in the same sentence.
But is it, though?
Ugh.
Because I'm pretty sure there's a lot of people who've done a lot of things like this
in government.
Yeah, yeah. Ultimately, the judge gave Cass... I mean,
there's one on the fucking Supreme Court right now.
Oh, yeah. Fucking sorry. Kavanaugh. Sorry.
Just got really upset.
Yeah.
It's got sad.
I know. Ultimately, the judge gave Hasser a 15-month prison sentence. Just to put that in perspective, it was recommended by the prosecutors that it was 6 months. So, again, based on the financial crimes, like, mm-hmm. there is a maximum sentence. So he got him 15 months in prison, 2 years of supervised release, sex offender treatment, and a $250,000 fine. Hasser did not appeal the sentence, and after serving 13 months, Hasser was released from prison and returned to Chicago. There were a few lawsuits that came after sentencing. In 2016, Individual A sued Hasser for breach of contract, and Hasser countersued to try and get his hush money back. Mm-hmm. He was like, no, just give me all the money back. The case is actually, there's a little back and forth. The case is actually settled in late 2021 for an undisclosed amount. Another lawsuit by a man named Richard Doe alleged that Hastert had sexually assaulted him in the bathroom in Yorkville, but because the statute of limitations had run out on abuse, the case was dismissed. Mm-hmm. This is the piece that I find probably the most interesting is, so Hastert lost his teacher's pension with the state of Illinois.
That's surprising.
Which he did try to, fight because he was like, the crimes that I was convicted of, the fraud crimes, didn't occur while I was teaching, mm-hmm. but they stem from abuse that happened while you were teaching.
I'm actually pretty surprised.
You fuckwit. So yeah. He also lost his pension from the Illinois General Assembly because he received a pension for working for the state General Assembly. As of 2015, he was still receiving his congressional pension.
That tracks.
Like, what the fuck? Mm-hmm. I don't know. That, to me, I was probably the most surprised about. Like, seriously? Like, we're still paying this asshat's pension, congressional pension.
I'm not surprised. Yeah. I'm not surprised about anything.
Gross.
I'm surprised he lost any pensions at all.
I mean, I'm glad he did.
Yeah. Take more.
But I'm sure he's still going to be hired out as, like, a senior advisor to lobbying firms if he's not retired already.
Isn't he dead yet?
No.
Damn.
Unfortunately not. So that is the story of Dennis Hassard. He's still around.
Hassard the bastard.
If you see him in Chicago.
Spit on him.
I am not advocating for.
I am. Spit on him.
So how about, first of all, let's just give a blanket, like, do not sexually abuse children.
Yeah, I didn't know we had to do that, but sure, yeah.
But also, check out this podcast.
Murder Road Trip is a true crime podcast where I, your host, Haley, discuss murder cases in my car, aka the Mobile Beats Lab. Join me and my partner in crime, H.H. Gnomes, on the road. There will be games, mixtapes, and snacks as I make the research journey to murder scenes around the world. Make sure to check your back seat, and I'll see you at the next rest stop.
It's a horrible segue.
Listen!
This is the worst segue we've ever done.
I would have done something related. I had to do something related to the episode.
There's so many other things.
I just said, don't sexually abuse children. I thought that was a good sentiment. Do you disagree?
Don't disagree with the sentiment. I disagree with the segue.
I'm sorry.
I'm mortified. We need a boo. I need a boo in here. Boo.
I like that. I wish it was longer. So if you haven't noticed, Janelle for our anniversary gave me, it's called Instant Audience, and it's like a little soundboard thing.
I feel like we needed to really bring some more radio vibes into here and have a soundboard.
Yes. Maybe we'll invest
got in our hip. I was just like, let's get the most absurd ones that don't make sense and we'll somehow use them.
All right, folks, that has been our episode this week. I don't actually think we have any announcements right now.
It's going to be low key.
It is. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more like this at badtastecrimepod.com, where we have all of our episodes and links to our merch store. if you wanted to check that out. Merch it up. Or to our donate page if you wanted to support the show. What else? You can
go on our YouTubes.
Go on our YouTubes. Check out our Facebook and Instagram. We're kind of everywhere.
Yeah.
Just check it out. Drop us a line. We love when you guys say hi. I think that's it.
Yeah.
It's weird to not have anything to talk about at the end of the episode.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we just got done doing a live show, so we're going to take a little time to just do the pod.
Yes. just focus on the pod. All right. With that said, our sound and editing is by Tiff Fullman. Our music is by Jason Jakshevsky, the Enigma. I just have like all sorts of buttons on my desktop.
Now I feel amazing. Like we need to do a sound for Tiff. Get the clap, the audience. Do we clap. Have, oh, here. Oh, we know. What's the other one? How many are on there? I forgot.
Four. There's a
crickets. I forgot.
Pause. The crickets. I don't want to give her crickets. No. That's mean. Oh yeah.
There we go. That works.
Yeah. We will be back with you guys in 2 weeks. Goodbye.
Bye.
Left their bodies on the hillsides along the highway. It was as if a wave of evil washed over this town.